You are listening to Passing Notes Unscripted, the real deal commentary and interviews just as they happened, or at least as close as we can get. Passing Notes is with me, Mark Hayes. Here we talk about music, books, sports, comics, movies, whatever else comes along. I'm coming to you from the back room, Studio B, and as the deal is with our unscripted podcast, we try to reuse all the material, or at least as much of it as we can, from our broadcast feature, which you can hear Fridays at 11.05 a.m. on WDNA 88.9 FM here in the South Florida market. You can also listen online at wdna.org. The podcast is always available through FeedBurner and iTunes, and if you like what you hear, you can find all kinds of content available through our website at markehayes.net. There you can find links to social media and become a friend of note. And if you're listening on iTunes, please do me a favor. If you like what you hear, if you don't like it, please just leave a review on iTunes and let people know what you think. My guest for today, although I did have the conversation a while ago in advance of the Miami Book Fair, my guest is Grail Marcus, who is the author of a new book on Bob Dylan. It's a collection of his writings about Bob Dylan, reviews and commentary, and just a really awesome, awesome and hefty book. It covers Marcus's writings on Bob Dylan from 1968 to 2010, and I've read it, and I have been listening to Dylan intensely for the past month or so to try to get a better grip on what Marcus is talking about. You probably know Grail Marcus for writing many, many very important and insightful works on American culture, particularly American music. And I know two of the really profound books that I have in my collection in terms of how I try to approach writing about music and culture in general, Lipstick Traces and Mystery Train. And I had such a great time talking with Marcus. It was a real pleasure, and I'm so happy that he was generous with his time and his answers. So we're going to go right to our conversation. I called him at his office in New York. Is it me, or is your rate of publication of books accelerating? Can you attribute this to like an increase in productivity, or is it just kind of the happy result of a productive career?
Well, you know, there was a three, four-year period where I didn't publish any books because I was working on the Harvard New Literary History of America, which I edited with Werner Salore, and that was a four-year project, and it was really all-consuming. It was 4 years from the time that Werner and I signed on, but really about 3 years from the time we assembled an editorial board, we made the assignments, we got the pieces in, we made the book, and I still can't believe we did it in 3 years. But that, you know, that made everything else go by the side. And then last August, I wrote this short book on Van Morrison that came out this spring. And the Dylan book was something I'd wanted to do for a while, and it never seemed like the right time until Barack Obama's election. I was at a Dylan show at the University of Minnesota on election night in 2008. It was the first time he had ever played there. He'd gone to college there for a while. And it was a fabulous show, and it was timed so that it would end just before the election would be called, so that it would really become part of that event. I wrote a piece about that, and when that piece came out, I looked at it, and I said, if I were to do a Dylan book, this would be the end of it. This would be the last piece in it. And so that, you know, the book kind of shaped itself backward in that sense. Because of the bizarre publishing schedule, both of the book and The Believer, where I write a music column every month, right, the most recent piece in the book has a dateline of September 2010, and the book came out in October. So that looks kind of weird. But you know, there are a number of pieces from 2009 and 2010, but you know, there is an ending section of the book about the election from 2 years ago.
Now, in your introduction and the prologue, you talk about the arcs of Dylan's career, a sort of post-legend, like after 1968 or so, and your own career as a critic. There's a practical matter of this approach, but There's also this critical question of, you know, what happened to Bob Dylan after he became this legend, which I thought was really fascinating, and that you're dealing with that, the problem that Dylan faces, which is that he's at the top of the mountain, and then what does he do? I wonder if you could talk about that, you know, the way you, your starting point and your end point, a bit more about the arc and what was this kind of central critical question you're trying to work through.
Sure. Well, I first saw Bob Dylan in 1963 at a Joan Baez concert. I'd never heard of him. She brought him out as a guest. I wasn't expecting to see him. I didn't know what to make of him, but I was just completely transfixed and thrilled by what he was doing. And then I saw him many times over the next couple of years and became a huge fan. I started writing for publication in 1968, and the very first piece in the book is from 1968. But I started writing about Dylan after John Wesley Harding came out. The first piece I wrote about Dylan was, other than that 68 piece, was on Nashville Skyline. It's not in the book because it was just terrible. And there was nothing to rescue from it that I could find. And, you know, but it was at a time when clearly the, you know, the sense of him as an avatar, I think maybe that's the best word for the way so many people were caught up with him in the mid to late 60s, was already fading. And for a fan or a beginning writer, it was like, what's going on? What's happening here? You know, what's missing? Is it me? You know, but, right. You know, there's clear sense that there's a whole dimension, there's a whole sense of gravity that isn't there anymore, or that's fading away. And so, you know, in my book, there is a certain amount of flailing around, and there's also overrating things because you want them to be as, you want to believe they're as good as you want them to be. And they aren't necessarily. Dylan is very eloquent about all of this in his own book and Chronicle.
Right.
You know, he writes off, I can't remember the exact number of years, I can't remember, it's 27 or 30 years of his career from basically John Wesley Harding until the early 90s. He says, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't always care what I was doing. But he's very explicit by saying he had reached a point in terms of his fame, in terms of the hopes people invested in him, and maybe most perversely, the way people identified with him, he's me. You know, he and I are soul brothers.
Yeah.
If we could only meet, we'd know how close we were. And you know, having to find some way to get out from under that and flailing around himself, making music that he didn't necessarily care that much about, making music that he didn't care anything about. He describes self-portrait in his own book as recording a lot of stuff, throwing it all up against the wall and releasing what stuck, and then later releasing everything else. And then reaching a point where, you know, his attempt to get out from under this burden of fame and expectation on the part of so many people left him in a place where he no longer had any idea of what he wanted to do. And he began to feel as if his own ability to make music, to speak, to communicate, to talk about something that he actually cared about was disappearing too. And some of those dramatic and painful parts of his own book are, you know, where he's stranded and he has no idea what to do with himself.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for me as a writer who's not privy to this kind of knowledge and really isn't trying to figure out what's going on in Bob Dylan's mind or his private life, I don't care about that. It's
yeah.
none of my business.
Your aesthetics. But, you're looking at the aesthetic side of things.
Yeah, I'm listening, and I'm saying, well, what's happening in these songs, and why does this come across, and why doesn't that? And what story is being told here, you know, even if only in fragments, what story isn't being told here? The bulk of the book is from around 1992 onward. When I start writing about Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong, these albums of old blues and old folk songs that he started releasing in the early 90s that to me were just a revelation. I mean, in the singing, guitar playing, the commitment of the performer to his material, the way he gets it across that, you know, nothing is funnier than this song, nothing is more painful, nothing carries more the weight of history than this moment in this song. You know, just the sense of high stakes presented on these very casual, unproduced albums. And that's when I think a second career began for him, and where while I am keeping up and I have never lost interest and I am, you know, infuriated and gratified as the years go on, here's where I say, okay, now there's a subject. Now there's a new story unfolding. This is going to be so fascinating, and it has been.
You have this amazing paragraph where you write about Bob Dylan's voice and what happened to it. You describe it as that sick sound, and you say, you know, you first heard the hint of it on John Wesley Harding. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I remember listening to John Wesley Harding for the very first time on the radio, and, you know, where I lived in the Bay Area, when a new Dylan album came out, they would put it on the radio and they'd play the whole thing straight through.
Right.
And so my wife and I were listening to it. It was probably about 11 o'clock, and we're listening to it, and we're just, you know, seduced by this record, and we want to hear everything three times. And then we get to I Pity the Poor Immigrant, and my wife said, he doesn't sound good. And I said, what do you mean? She said, he sounds sick. And she didn't mean he was literally sick, but she meant it was the sound of someone who was ill, you know, who could barely rise off his bed to croak into the microphone, which is actually how Jimmy Rogers recorded his last songs when he was dying of tuberculosis. Really, he was lying on a cot, you know, and they'd bring the microphone to him. Later in, you know, many years later in Dylan's career, 20 years later, when I'm listening to things like Knocked Out Loaded or Under the Red Sky or Empire Burlesque, that sound came back, and I remembered what she said, but, you know, maybe it was an effect. Maybe it was just a way of getting something across on John Wesley Harding, but by 20 years later, it was the voice. It was what was being communicated. It was the sound of someone who was doing something he didn't want to do. He was in a place where he didn't want to be, and that's what I meant by that.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to get across by using, you know, this notion of a sick voice.
You know, it was gratifying to see so much writing about the band, and of course material that reminded me of Mystery Train. I find that as much as I love the band, you know, many average sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill music fans know almost next to nothing about them. How important is the band in terms of understanding what Dylan is doing, and how important do you feel the band still is?
Well, in terms of how important the band are vis-a-vis Bob Dylan, they're important for what they did when they were the Hawks, when they were playing with him in 65 and 66. That was a real partnership, and they were discovering each other's music at that time, and they were each pushing each other farther. The band was pushing Dylan as a singer, and he was pushing them as a band in terms of invention, in terms of improvisation, never knowing what he was going to do next. And the sound that came out of that was a sound of just unparalleled drama and intensity and grandeur, really. And then when they worked together, when they played together in 1967, making the Basement Tapes, which weren't called anything at that point. It was just what they were doing, fooling around every afternoon up in the Catskills. And that ended up producing some of the most lasting and revelatory and unique music that either the Hawks or Dylan ever did. But after that, you know, the band had their career and Dylan had his, and they might play together, they might tour together, but it's a separate thing. What's the same is that in very different ways, they're both in asking themselves the same question. What is America? What's it made out of? What counts? What doesn't? What are the stories that people have always told each other? What are the stories that people have been afraid to tell each other? John Wesley Harding and the band's first two albums, you know, are about those questions. And they answer them very differently, with very different sound and different kind of humor, different sort of playfulness, and different sort of bitterness even. So there was a time when they were looking down the same road. But the band is interesting in and of itself. I mean, its own story, its own music. So the pieces on the band are in the book because of their connection with Dylan, but also because, you know, once you get past that, the story has its own claim.
And although you've added more about the band to the notes and discography section of Mystery Train in the later editions, do you have a more comprehensive statement that you still want to make about that group?
No, I said what I had to say in the piece called The Lost Waltz that's in the book. When Robbie Robertson was putting together what was supposed to be the definitive band box set after a really botched release a number of years ago, and he was putting together what he called a musical history, and I can't remember if it had 6 CDs and 1 DVD or 7 CDs and 1 DVD, but very big. And he asked me to write the liner notes, and I did. And they were rejected because they were, you know, they were about a band that had gone to the top of the mountain and then came down. The piece, you know, began with the deaths of Richard Manuel and Rick Danko, and it ended up being a piece about what the band found that no one else had ever found and what they lost, you know, as a group. It was not the celebration that they were looking for. And I wasn't at all surprised, you know, that they rejected it, and I wasn't angry about it. As John Wayne used to say, I got paid, and I got paid. But I said what I had to say, and I don't have much to add to it. You know, the whole first half of that piece is about a single song. Mm-hmm. It's about King Harvest Has Surely Come, and about the way the song works, what's going on in that song. And at the end of that, I thought, for me anyway, I said what I had to say about what the band accomplished, what was singular about them.
One of the things I've been doing the past week is asking people, how many Dylan shows have you seen? And I haven't seen Bob Dylan. I'm a little ashamed to say that now, and I you know, maybe I can rectify that, hopefully, in the near future. But I ask people, how many shows have you seen, and sort of what happened at the show? You know, some people are wiser in their, you know, set of expectations, and some people kind of have a bitterness about it. But what advice would you give to sort of a neophyte going to a Bob Dylan concert? You know, what do they need to be aware of, or what's the best approach for someone who might be going to a concert these days, at least?
Don't expect anything.
Yeah.
That's the best advice. Don't expect to hear your favorite song. Don't expect not to. But figure that here's a guy who's playing 100 shows a year or something like that, and they're all going to be different. You know, there are going to be things that are similar about each one. The first song and the last song might be the same every night, but the stuff in the middle is going to be very, very different, and it might not even be planned out before the show. It might change in the course of the show according to the way the crowd is responding, the way the musicians are working with each other. You know, maybe we are good enough tonight to do such and such. So don't go expecting anything. And I would say, if you can, go to a show where it's not all reserved seating. the last Dylan show I went to was in late August in Oakland, California, at this old Art Deco movie palace. Really wonderful place.
Yeah.
Really spectacular place. I'd never been to a show there before. You know, I don't think there were any reserved seats. There was a balcony that had seats, and there's a whole front of the hall that didn't have seats. It was just standing.
Oh.
And then there was a kind of mezzanine with some tables and chairs. But it was full but not overcrowded. There were lots of younger people, I mean people in their 20s, lots of people dancing. And I don't mean doing the deadhead dance that infected so many Bob Dylan concerts after he toured the Grateful Dead, and the Deadheads decided that, you know, Dylan was really part of the Grateful Dead, and so you had to go to his shows and stand up and wave your arms and sway back and forth and block everybody's view. No, I mean really dancing, you know, like the songs with a beat. That's what I'd say. It's very interesting. I don't know who Dylan's audience is today. Somebody asked me about this last show I'd been to, and she said it was the audience 90% male. And I said, I didn't really notice.
Right.
Maybe, I don't know. She said, well, every show I've been to, you know, it's been all guys, which is kind of interesting because I know so many women used to find Dylan so sexy.
Of course.
And I'm sure plenty still do. After the show that I went to in Oakland, Dylan announced that he was doing a show the next day in San Francisco. You know, hadn't been announced before that moment. It was going to have a low price. There were going to be no reserve seats, no advance ticket sales. You had to get in line that day, get your tickets, and go. It was a way of beating scalpers. It was a way of getting, you know, opening the shows up to people for less money. I didn't go to that show. I don't know who was inside, but it was such an interesting thing for somebody to do that all the local TV stations covered it as a news story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would go to see people standing in line saying, well, why are you here, and stuff like that. And everybody I saw was in their 20s or maybe early 30s at the oldest. That was interesting.
Are there any musical artists that are working today that you feel are so strongly rooted and connected to this music that anyone who's interested in roots music, you know, music of the 20s and 30s and going back to the 19th century as much as Dylan, is there anyone who's really done his or her homework?
Well, I mean, there are a number of people I'd mention. The Hanson family. Okay, the Hanson family are a husband and wife, Brett and Rennie Sparks. They started making music in Chicago. They're now in Albuquerque. And they've made close to a dozen albums over the past 10, 12 years where they're essentially working in the vein of the American surrealist folk song,
mm-hmm.
the strange song. But Rennie Sparks writes the words, Brett Sparks adapts them into music and does almost all the singing and plays almost all the instruments. And Rennie Sparks is a writer unlike any other. One of her songs begins, "There's a fish in my stomach 1,000 years old."
I've heard that song. I have heard that song. Yes.
Instantly are taken into this realm of both complete realism and complete strangeness. I mean, somebody says, "There's a fish in my stomach 1,000 years old," and while the sentence makes no literal sense, you immediately know what that person means. I am carrying the weight of the world on my back, except it's in my stomach. That's where I feel it. And she's a genius at being able to do this, to transmogrify the impulses of American folk music into songs that no one else would ever write, no one but she and Brett would ever perform. So that's one group. Another is Snake Farm, which is really the singer Anna Domino and her husband, taking old traditional American songs, Streets of Laredo, Tom Dooley,
yeah.
Frankie and Albert, and singing them in an abstract, almost techno manner, turning them all into a very odd kind of dance music. There's the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Have you heard them?
I have heard them, yeah.
And I've been playing recently, their album and wondering where their second album is because I love this one so much. And listening to Snowden's Jig, Genuine Negro Jig,
oh,
which
boy.
Is an old minstrel instrumental that they do.
Yeah.
And I don't know how the song was played in the 1840s or 50s. I'm sure they took this off of sheet music.
Yeah.
But I'm sure their version is both completely accurate and completely their own. And it becomes like a dream of the minstrel show where in your waking life, in your conscious life, you think, you know, this racist travesty. But in your dream, where your ego cannot control what you think, it becomes something beautiful. It becomes a dream of harmony and peacefulness. And then you wake up and you say, "Oh my God, what have I done?" So, I think, you know, their music is extraordinarily subtle, and has great tension, and is really fun, and, you know, has great warmth to it and a sting too.
I teach an American Studies course, and each year I do a little bit more on minstrelsy, and it was always a very nervous thing to bring up in the classroom, but I find that, and maybe it's the person in the White House, I find that it's easier to talk about now. I don't know if that's just me or if that's just something that's going on. It seems like in some areas you can kind of look at this, as you say, like it's a travesty. It's shocking to see, but on the other hand, you know, there's so much to learn.
You know, Constance Rourke in American Humor, and she was writing in 1931.
Yeah.
When she writes about the blackface minstrel, she makes a direct, strong argument that what today we call the true soul, let's say, use Du Bois' phrase, that the soul of black folk comes through the blackface mask worn by the white performer, and that either intentionally with great empathy, as with Daddy Rice, or not intentionally, against all intentions, as with Dan Emmett and so many other people, the predicament, the tragedy, the trap, the imprisonment, the longing, and the bitterness of the African-American, i.e. the slave, is coming through in the travesties that white people are making of their songs and sayings and folk tales. And I think that argument had to seem bizarre in 1931, and it seems bizarre when you first encounter it now. But people like W.T. Lehman have
right.
done enormous work to show how this could have happened, how this could really be. And when you look at Al Jolson, you know, when you look at his best blackface performances, I wouldn't ever say that anything of the black American comes through his blackface mask, but he comes to life, and he becomes an alluring, glamorous figure in a way that he absolutely isn't when the blackface isn't on. He's this most ordinary-looking guy who talks kind of slowly when he's white, and when he's got blackface on, he just wants to tell the whole world what a great place it is.
Well, we're all doing the cakewalk in one way or another, right?
Well, have you ever heard his little disquisition on Mammy songs? In the box set of The Jazz Singer, there's a lot of extra things, and one of them is a soundie that he did before The Jazz Singer, the year before The Jazz Singer, called The Plantation Act. You know, here he is on a fake plantation set, and he's dressed as a field hand, and he's got blackface, and he doesn't look the least bit African-American. You know, he looks like a black Jew, I guess. Or he looks like a Jewish guy in blackface. But as soon as he starts singing and talking, you kind of forget all this, because he's not overdoing a dialect. He's not speaking in dialect at all. And he's not singing in a black dialect, but he says, you know, people are criticizing Mammy songs, and they're saying they're too many Mammy songs. He says, but Mammy songs are the foundation of our culture. And then he says it that way, like he's a professor making an argument about the nature of American culture. It's just shocking, and it's funny, and it's wonderful, and then he goes and proves it.
Now, if we're sitting in the studio and I've got a reasonably well-stocked public radio jazz and blues collection behind me, if there were a blues song that you would want to put on and listen to in sort of reference to Bob Dylan, is there a song that you would pick, and why would you pick that song?
One would be James Alley Blues by Rabbit Brown from the Anthology of American Folk Music. On the liner notes to Bob Dylan's first album, which I guess were written by Robert Shelton under a different name, several of Dylan's favorite singers are listed, and one is Rabbit Brown. And, you know, most people, like me, when they thought of it, who's Rabbit Brown? It doesn't say who he was or is. You know, either then or later, you encounter the Anthology of American Folk Music, and you find him there. You find out he was a New Orleans singer. He only recorded once in 1927, and this is one of his songs. It's a song that Dylan tried to sing a few times very early on in 61 or so, you know, at friends' apartments and stuff. And then I think he recasts for Blind Willie McTell, either, or maybe it just, this song lies behind that as a kind of guardian angel of the song. But I think in this performance, you can hear so much of what Bob Dylan has done over the years, both as a guitar player and as a singer and as a songwriter and as a humorist, as a black humorist. And I think you can hear a shade of Bob Dylan, put it that way. Somebody recording, years before he was born, many, many years before he began performing.
Nothing like it used to be. And I'm telling you all the truth. Oh, take it for me. I haven't seen better days, but I ain't putting up with me. I haven't seen better days, but I'm putting up with me. I can have a much better time with these girls. Now it's so hard to see. Cause I was born in the country, cause I needed to rule. Cause I was born in the country, she thinks I'm easy to rule. She tried to hit me to a wagon, she wanna drive me like a mule. You know, I bought the groceries, and I paid the rent. Yeah, I buy the groceries, and I paid the rent. She tried to make me wash her clothes, but I got good common sense. I said, if you don't want me, why don't you tell me so? You know that if you don't want me, why don't you tell me so? Because it ain't like a man that ain't got nowhere to go. I've been giving you sugar for sugar, let you get salt for salt. I'll give you sugar for sugar, let you get salt for salt. And if you can't get along with me, well, it's your own fault. How you want me to love you and you treat me mean? How do you want me to love you? Keep but treat me mean. You my daily thought and my nightly dream. Sometimes I think it's you too sweet to die. Sometimes I think it's you too sweet to die. And another time I think you ought to be buried alive.
Another song I play would be Mattie Mae Thomas, who was an inmate, I guess in Mississippi, I guess at Parchman. And she was recorded in 1939 by a folklorist. This guy shows up, he asks, the director of the women's section of the prison, who the good singers are among the inmates. She brings out various people and they perform for him. You know, they just sing a cappella. There's no accompaniment. And Mattie Mae Thomas just happens to be one of the great singers in American history. And when you listen to her, I think he recorded four or five songs by her that day. You realize this is not a folk voice. This is not a field voice. This is a trained voice. This is someone who was a professional singer early in her life before she ended up in prison. This is someone who might have sung in nightclubs. She might have sung in juke joints. She might even have sung on the street, but as a professional singer, as someone who knew what she wanted her voice to do and knew how to make it do what she wanted it to do. And what she's singing, Dangerous Blues, she's singing an old tall tale, singing an old, I wrestled with lions and I rode on the backs of alligators and, I'm the toughest he-man in the county and I can I use a rattlesnake for a belt. I use a rattlesnake for a necktie, and I use hollow logs for my shoes, and you know, all this kind of thing. And yet she's singing it in a voice of such desperation and isolation, as if she's already dead, as if she died, and yet somehow she wasn't allowed to leave the earth. And she has to walk the earth, and nobody can see her. And she keeps trying to talk to people, but nobody can hear her. That's the feeling of it. And I play that to say that's a place Dylan hasn't reached yet.
Now, I wasn't able to find the exact track Marcus was talking about here, but I did find a version of Dangerous Blues sung by Maggie Jones and recorded in the early to mid-1920s. Let's listen to Dangerous Blues by Maggie Jones.
When you see a red flag waving, you can bet it's danger there. Look at me, I'm mad and raving, dangerous as a grizzly bear. I'm like a red hot stove, I'm burning down. I'm like a red hot stove, I'm burning.
Crosby was ever even in it, and it's kind of surprising when he comes back. it becomes a real desert, and what the singer has to do is cross it. And I think that spirit is in a lot of Dylan's music.
Mama done told me when I was in short pants. My mama done told me, son, a woman will sweet talk, then give you the big eye. When that sweet talking's done, a woman's a two-face, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. Now the rains have fallen, hear the train a-calling, hoo-wee. My mama done told me, hear that lonesome whistle blowing across the trestle, hoo-wee. My mama done told me, a-hoo-wee da-hoo-wee, old clickety-clack echoing back the blues in the night. The evening breeze will start the trees to crying, and the moon will hide its light when you get the blues in the night. Take my word, old mockingbird will sing the saddest kind of song. He knows things is wrong, and he's right. From Natchez to Mobile, from Memphis to St. Joe, wherever the four wind blows. I've been in some big towns, I heard me some big talk, but there's one thing I know. A woman's a two-face, a worrisome thing who'll leave you to sing the blues in the night. My mama was right, there's blues in the night.
Probably the last place you expected to end up in terms of what you were listening to when you started this podcast was a tune from Bing Crosby, but there it is, Blues in the Night, provided to us as a reference point for understanding what's going on in the career of Bob Dylan. Grill Marcus, of course, his latest book is a collection of writings from 1968 to 2010 on Bob Dylan, an artist that Marcus has been writing about for virtually his whole career, and it is an outstanding book. It is out now from Public Affairs Books. You can visit the publisher's website at publicaffairsbooks.com. And I want to say thank you again to Grill Marcus for talking with me and being so generous with his time and his thoughts. And I want to thank you for listening. Remember to check out the Passing Notes website at markeehayes.net, where you can find fresh daily content of all sorts. If you listen to the podcast on iTunes, please do me a favor and take a few moments and give it a rating. In the meantime, I do hope you find something out there in the world that interests you. I hope you pay close attention. Be well.
I wanna ride it. Texas sliding down. Folks are losing their possessions, folks are leaving.
in town. But the music shaking, broken, dancing, hanging on the wall. So you're dancing with Jimmy 22, and you don't dance at all. Oh, it's a room.